If in 1961 you had invested $1,000 in this man's company, today you would be sitting on $5 million. On Uncommon Knowledge, one of the signal figures in American business history, Charles Koch. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Born and raised in Wichita, Kansas, Charles Koch studied at MIT, worked for a few years back east, then returned to Wichita to join his father's business, then a medium-sized oil company, in 1961. In 1966, he became president of the business, which he renamed Koch Industries in honor of his father. In the half a century since, Koch Industries has grown so dramatically that it now represents the second largest privately held company in the United States. Its products run from oil to polymers to paper products to pipelines to fiber optics, and it employs almost 100,000 people, 60,000 of them here in this country. Worth $21 million in 1961, Koch Industries, of which Mr. Koch remains chairman and CEO, is now worth $100 billion. With his brother David, Charles Koch is active in politics, funding think tanks and campaigns. Mr. Koch is also the author of a number of books, including, most recently, Good Profit. Charles Koch, welcome. Actually, I ordinarily say welcome when we're in our studio, but you are kind enough to invite us into your home, so thank you for welcoming us here to your home in Indian Wells, California.
Well, thanks for having me on your program. I've watched it a number of times, and I don't deserve to be on it given the quality of the others, but I take that as a high compliment, and I thank you for it.
All right, the opening gambit is modesty then. Well, from Good Profit. Good Profit is creating, this is the way you define your title. Good Profit is creating superior value for our customers while consuming fewer resources and always acting lawfully and with integrity. Now, Charles, your common understanding of profit is money is money. What has integrity got to do with it?
Well, it has to do with this. Now, if you want to make a quick buck, you can do it a lot of different ways. You can cheat somebody, you can misrepresent something, you can go manipulate the political system to get an advantage. But if you want to be successful over a long period of time, I believe you need to focus first of all on creating value for others. And that's naive, that's utopian. No, it isn't, because why will the customers want to pay you anything over a long period unless you're creating value for them? Why would your employees want to work for you? Or if they did, they didn't have any alternative, why do they want to give their best efforts? Why do they want to get excited? Why would they wake up at night with ideas? If you're in a community, a plant in a community, unless you're creating value for that community, why would the community want you there if you're polluting and hurting people and not contributing anything to the community? So long-term success starts with being dedicated to creating value for others. It's not altruism. It's my whole philosophy is to have a system of mutual benefit, where both parties gain, a society based on win-win.
All right, one of the aspects of Good Profits that's so interesting to me is that you provide something of an intellectual history. That makes it sound pompous. It's a very readable, enjoyable book, but that you're talking about your own intellectual journey. Young man in Wichita, you go off to MIT, you begin reading, you try to figure life out. And as you're reading at MIT and during your few years as you're working back east, I'm going to quote you now, the conclusions you reached. The more books I read, the more passionately I embraced the truth that widespread human well-being demands property rights, allows people to speak freely, refrains from interference in private parties' agreements and exchanges, and allows human action, that is markets, allows human action to guide prices. Close quote. So we've got the young man from Wichita embracing the Scotsman Adam Smith and the Austrian economists Friedrich Hayek and Ludwig von Mises. You find your way to classical liberalism. How did that happen?
Well, it happened because I discovered at an early age, I didn't think I was much good at anything, but my father did me a big favor. He had me working in all my spare time from the time I was six, because he announced he didn't want his sons to be country club bums. He wanted us to feel grateful for everything and entitled to nothing. And for whatever reason.
And when you say working, he didn't give you some cushy office job in the company.
No, particularly at age six. I started out digging dandelions. And when I say dig dandelions, you don't pull them out. You dig down and you have to get the entire root or they'll come right back. And I remember there was a club and a swimming pool across the street from us. And I'm out there in 105 degree heat digging these. And I could hear my friends, my little six-year-old friends, they're swimming and jumping off the diving board. And I could recognize each one's squeal was different of joy. And I'm thinking, why does my father hate me and their fathers love them? I found out that if you don't, and then I, of course, graduated to shoveling out stalls and milking cows. And that doesn't sound like much work, but it's hard work. So I would milk cows before school and then again after school, milk our cows, and digging post holes and all these things. But I discovered that much later that if you don't learn to do dirty jobs, if you don't learn unpleasant work, you, by the time you're in your 30s, you never learn to work productively. And so he was doing me a huge favor. So it was beyond the work ethic. It taught you how to work productively and how to work with others in mutual benefit. For example, if a group of you are doing a dirty job, you don't try to stick it to them, make them do more, then they'll try to do it to you, and the work goes on and on. You want to work together to get it done as efficiently as possible. You want to understand who your customer is. What does my customer want? What does he value? I better do this the right way or I'll have to do it again. So you learn tremendous number of lessons in doing these dirty jobs. So that was the starting point. And then I learned, I didn't think I was much good at anything, and the other thing you learn is you don't want to do that the rest of your life.
Right, right.
So you better find some aptitude or something so you can do something that's more satisfying and fulfilling to yourself and is not as unpleasant. So I didn't find much any good. And then in the third grade, I found the teacher was putting math problems on the board. And I asked, why is she doing that? The answer is obvious. Oh. It wasn't obvious to the other kids.
Right.
Oh my God, I have an aptitude. So from then on, everything I did was the easy way out in that I'm going to take more math and more science and logic and things that I'm good at and try to minimize having to do the things I'm no good at. So I went to MIT, where the language is primarily math, not English, because I was so much better at math than English. And even though I got all these engineering degrees at MIT.
By the way, it's worth noting, you got your undergraduate degree in engineering at MIT. You got a master's, correct me if I'm wrong, but as I recall, you got a master's in mechanical engineering.
Nuclear engineering.
And then you got a second master's in
Chemical engineering.
So 1, 2, 3 MIT degrees in engineering. It's amazing you retained the facility to speak English.
Well, that's true. Well, I had to relearn that. But even though I took all these engineering degrees, really what I maximized my time on was courses in math and science.
Right.
Because I was much better at that than the application of the principles. So, and that may be one reason I got one in nuclear engineering, because it was mainly science.
And then I also thought
it was a new field. This is the way energy is going to go, so there'll be entrepreneurial opportunities. And when I got in it, I realized, because of all the safety concerns, it's going to be controlled by the government, and it's not going to be. So I went back and got a degree in chemical engineering.
But you're saying your bent of mind was almost more theoretical than applied.
It was.
Pure
it
math.
Was in Howard Gardner's Multiple Intelligence, is what he calls logical mathematical intelligence. Okay. And he had, I didn't know Howard Gardner then or of him, but that I later learned that that's the particular aptitude I had. So in the process, I learned that it's an ordered universe, that the physical world is ordered and governed by certain principles. So I said to myself, well, if I'm going to be successful in the physical world, that is making technical innovations and learning how things work, I've got to understand the philosophy of science and the scientific method. So after I got out of MIT, that was my fascination. I was read everything I could on starting in Aristotle, Descartes, Popper, Kuhn, Polanyi, Einstein, Newton. I mean, that was my reading.
And all this time, you're working back east for Arthur D. Little.
Arthur D. Little, who
in accounting and consulting.
No, it wasn't accounting.
What
no,
was
Arthur
it in those
D.
Days?
Little is was back then was. One of the leading full-range consulting companies. And I started in product development, and then I got to move over to process development. And an interesting project we had, one client we had was the Chemical Corps, and they had this idea that they would make aerosol bombs out of marijuana derivatives. And so I helped design the plant to make this marijuana derivative that has 500 times the potency of regular marijuana. And the idea was to put it in a bomb, and then rather with a hostile population, rather than go have to kill a bunch of people, you'd drop these marijuana aerosol bombs on them, and they'd all be giggling and happy, and you could come lock them up, and everybody would be safe and peaceful. I apologize. I misspent some of the taxpayers' hard-earned money in that one. But anyway, and then
what I'm curious about is you leave MIT and you get a practical job, but your reading is all really quite. In other words, if I didn't know you were working at Arthur D. Little, if I just hear you talk about your intellectual interests, the reading you're doing, I'd say, oh, this is somebody who's working to become a professional academic. This is a professor in the making. I would not have predicted that you'd go back to Wichita and take over the company. I'd have predicted that you'd have put yourself up for a philosophy department, philosophy of science, and right now you'd be teaching at MIT.
Well, that's a matter of fact. That was my plan. First of all, I was thinking I'd get a PhD in math, and then I found out that, as smart as I thought I was in math, that when it got to really abstract math, it was beyond me. Like Norbert Wiener, who was a developer of cybernetics, was teaching then, and only the very brightest math students would go to his class. No one had any idea what he was talking about. So he would give everybody an A, because he couldn't distinguish, because they were all flunking his class and they were all the best students. So I knew I couldn't go there. So then I thought, well, I'll get a doctorate in chemical engineering. And I went to one of my favorite professors, and I said, well, what about this? He said, well, it depends on what you want to do. If you want to teach or be a researcher, yeah, but just keep in mind, we will make your life miserable. We'll have you do all our dirty jobs, make us look better, advance our careers, and you'll be kind of our slave. So if that's what you want to do, you need to go through that. If you want to go in business, get the hell out of here as quickly as you can. So I went off and thought about it, and I said, well, I think probably logic and math will be helpful in business as well. and that sounds like a lot more fun. So I got this job at Arthur D. Little, and then I started in product development, then I did process development, and then I got over in management services, and great learning experiences because we got to do consulting for Standard Oil New Jersey, now Exxon, DuPont, Copper, Stanley Work, all these sizable companies. And here I was like 24, 25, and I'd go get to make presentations to senior management. So talk about learning English.
Right, right.
I had to learn some English then to do this. So it was a great learning experience. And then after I'd been there about 2 years, my father calls me and wanted me to come back to work with him. And I turned him down because I was learning a lot. And I had no idea of going back. I mean, remember, he had been a tough taskmaster, and he had worked me to the bone, I thought. And one of his favorite sayings, being Dutch, is you can tell the Dutch, but you can't tell them much. So I thought, my God, I don't want to go back and get more of what I grew up under. So I said, thank you very much, but I got different career paths. So a couple of months later, he called me back and he said, son, either you come back to run the company or I'm going to have to sell it because I don't have long to live and I have no successor. And he says, and I'll tell you what, our main company is a company called Rock Island Oil and Refining. We don't have a refinery. We have a crude oil gathering system, and we bought an interest in another refining company. But we have a separate business that you boys own. I put it in your name. It's a very small company, but it makes refining equipment. It's called Koch Engineering. And it's not doing well. I haven't paid any attention to it. And I'll let you run that any way you want. The only thing you need my approval on is if you want to sell it. Now, I said, hey, get to run it. So rather than consulting on people on how to run companies, I can go run one.
And so, you were how old at this stage?
I was 25.
Got it.
And so I came back, and it was wonderful. He was absolutely true to his word. He let me run it, and it was such a mess that I didn't know what I was doing, but even with the little experience I had, I could make great improvements in it, and it blossomed. And so then he turned over a lot of the other company, and he actually made me president in 1966 as his health was really deteriorating, and then he died in 1967. So I got to work with him for 6 years.
You worked with your dad for 6 years. From 67 on, you remain CEO. You mentioned your siblings. At some point, you and your brother David bought out your siblings' interest.
Yeah.
But you remain CEO of the company for what's nearly half a century now.
That's right.
Is that correct? Now, I want to return once again to good profit. I just read the way you had come to the conclusion that the best society was a free society, private property, freedom of speech, and so forth. Here's another quotation from Good Profit that continues that thinking. I'm quoting you. As I digested this, it dawned on me that these principles of liberty, freedom, and so forth, are fundamental to the well-being not only of societies, but also of organizations, companies, which are essentially small societies, close quote. So I want to make sure I have this right. Koch Industries, this gigantic, enormously successful company as we see it today, back in your mind, in the mind of young Charles Koch in the late 60s, your father's gone, now you're in charge, Koch Industries is an experiment.
That's right.
You get to test your beliefs about human nature on this company.
That's right.
That's correct?
Oh, yeah. No, I had, when I was doing it, even when my father was still alive, I was trying these. But the way I came about this is, as I said, I was very interested in the philosophy of science, and I came across this essay of Polanyi's called The Republic of Science, and in which he outlines how scientists work together to create the most innovation and advance scientific understanding. And a key part of that, well, one part is to get all kinds of dispersed and desperate knowledge together. That's how you get innovations, when you have these conflicting ideas together and out of it comes something new. And another part is, which I also learned from Karl Popper, that the scientific method is to articulate a theory that's refutable,
right,
and then to spend as much time trying to disprove it as prove it. And he goes through what societies have done that and which ones, and those who apply this method, that is free societies, are those that progress, and others like communist societies who have what's politically correct and don't allow other ideas to compete with it, don't progress because they go down the wrong track. So I said, okay, we need this kind of challenge culture, this skepticism in our company. And so we're going to build a culture of challenge. That is, if you're a supervisor at any level and your people don't challenge you, you've got to change your ways or you can't be a supervisor because you're not using the ideas of your people. You're not building a republic of science. And if you're an employee and you don't challenge your supervisor, then you're not doing your job. Why don't we get another computer or a robot or something to do it, because you're not using your brain.
Let me interrupt there, because this gets us to what is the heart of much of good profit. You've spent, as I say, almost half a century now working on this experiment of Koch Industries.
Right.
And you've distilled your management technique into what you call market-based management, which has five basic components. Let's take a couple of those. You just touched on one. Knowledge, I'm quoting you again, knowledge processes. Not only is it permissible for employees at Coke to challenge their bosses if they think they have a better answer, but they have an obligation to do so.
Absolutely.
Close quote. Now in practice, I just said in the introduction, Coke Industries is now 9 different freestanding units, 100,000 employees around the world, only a little more than half, 60,000 in this country. How do you diffuse this? I mean, you could just say, well, this is very high sounding that Mr. Koch, when he was a young man, developed this idea of that we needed challenge culture in our company. Terrific. But now we have a big company, processes apply, the usual bureaucrat. How do you resist that? How do you actually infuse genuine challenge culture across an entity as large as this?
Well, I mean, it starts with values, and that's our, the five dimensions are vision, virtue and talents, knowledge processes you mentioned, decision rights and incentives. And they're all based, as you say, from my studies on how people can best live and work together, how societies can organize themselves to maximize well-being for everybody, not just for a select few. And so the starting point is having these values, what we call our 10 guiding principles, having them be who we are as a company. Many companies have lists of principles, but in many cases they put them on the wall and that's the end of it, or stick them in the drawer and that's the end of it. Our principles are who we are as a company. They guide everything we do. They determine who we hire, who we retain, who we promote, how you as an employee will be rewarded, everything. And a key part of those values is challenge. You've got to challenge, and you've got to be skeptical, and you've got to be committed to getting long-term results. Not just results this quarter, but we evaluate and reward people on long-term results. And I'm not saying it's easy or we're perfect. We're a long way from perfect in any of this, but we fight it every day. But one of the most difficult things we have when we acquire a company is building in this challenge culture, because in so many companies, if you challenge your boss, in particular if you're pushy about it, that can affect your career in a negative way.
Sure.
And we're the opposite. If you never challenge, that's going to affect your career in a negative way. If you challenge not to prove you're a smarty pants or show up somebody, but because you have an idea on how we can improve, how we can do better, how your boss's decision is a mistake. And if you do that, whether you're right or wrong, you're going to be celebrated and you're going to be rewarded for that, particularly, obviously, if it gets improves results.
Another of the five tenets of market-based management, virtue and talents. And again, I'm quoting from Good Profit. We can hire all the brightest MBAs in the world, and if they don't have the right values, we will fail. We hire based on values first, then talent. That's breathtaking. It's breathtaking. Well, first of all, just as a practical matter, how do you screen for values? How do you screen for values legally? You're not allowed to ask questions about people's religion. How do you do that? How do you hire based on values?
We're not concerned about religion. We're concerned about, do you have integrity? Do you have the courage to live by the values when they're tough? This is why Aristotle called courage the most important of all the virtues, because if you don't have it, you won't be able to exercise the other virtues when they're needed most. So courage, compliance, value creation, being dedicated to creating real value for our customers, for society, for the company, knowledge, challenge, treating others with dignity and respect, and then trying to have a job that's fulfilling to you, because we find, and this isn't just altruism, this is the philosophy of mutual benefit. If an employee has a fulfilling job, they're going to be more creative and more productive, and it makes their lives better.
Charles Koch, author of Good Profit, thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
For Uncommon Knowledge and the Hoover Institution, I'm Peter Robinson. Thank you.